live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Lot to share. Going to talk about hormones and behavior. Something very important that glucosamine and chondroitin can do in your body. Got the latest on the high fructose corn syrup and what it's doing that's really bad. And also going to talk about Pfizer-funded study. Well, we're going to show you that it's wrong and shouldn't have been allowed to be published by the mainstream media without challenge. From our public health segment today, from Reluca Schachter, time for a wake-up call. The vaccination hoax debunked. Wake up world, we'll talk about that. My guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Robert Burton. He is a board-certified physician specializing in the brain, the mind, neuroscience, and the philosophy of science. And he is going to talk about a continuation of a conversation about modern neuroscience and what it can and what it cannot tell us about our brains and ourselves. By the way, if you didn't have a chance to listen to last night's Progressive Commentary Hour, you should. It was also a continuation of our series of conversations with remarkable minds. This man, who I was speaking with from Uruguay, what a thinker. Wow. Also today, time permitting, issues. From Charles Durber, consumerism and its discontents. The 16 to 34-year-olds. Why are they beginning for the first time to question what they're buying? Also from the Tycoon Daily, America's corrupt justice system. Did you know that the federal private prison population grew by 784% in the last 10 years? How's that possible? Easy. They have just made a new slave trade in the United States. How ironic. We'll look at that. Stressed ecosystems leaving humanity high and dry. From InterPress Service, from Stephen Lee, we're going to talk about how much water is really pure and drinkable on the planet. Take a guess. Think you know? I'd like for you to email me or just call in, and our engineer will take it. 888-874-4888. So of 100% water, how much of it right now as we speak is actually clean enough for us to drink? And more importantly, how much of that is fresh water that we could drink, even if we had to purify it? I'd like to see how up on that you are. Now, there's one country in the world that's having some challenges with its rivers, and that's China. Okay, here's a question. According to China's first national census on water, they discovered how many major rivers. I'm not talking about streams or little brooks. I'm talking about rivers are no longer there in the last 20 years. Let's see if you get that one right, too. That's going to be an issue. Obama's distorts the just war principle. I felt that this really needed to be challenged because the mainstream media on the left and right were not challenging it. When he spoke over the weekend, justifying the counter-terrorism policy, he invoked the just war theory to justify the continued use of assassination by drones as America's increasingly favored war policy. All right. Here's where scholarship counts. Do you know what justifies the just war? There are some principles, and they're very specific, and they're laid out. Well, then, all of you who thought that Obama was correct, he's wrong. A response by Professor of Religious Ethics at Marquette University, Professor Daniel McGuire, will show you what constitutes the just war policy. How bad is it? Well, I'm filming. I had to refilm because I've taken so long filming this, and there's so much to film on poverty. And it just keeps getting worse. The real numbers. Right now, one half of all Americans are living in poverty. But it's going towards 75% in poverty. Why isn't the media, Congress, why isn't anyone doing anything about this? Not even being honest about it. We'll talk about that. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. New research shows that potatoes are one of the best nutritional values per penny. This is from the University of Washington. I'll quote it. It says, a frequently expressed concern in the ongoing public health debate is the lack of affordable fresh vegetables, especially those that are nutrient-dense. A new study entitled Vegetable Cost Metrics show that potatoes and beans provide most nutrients per penny. This was published in the respected peer-reviewed journal PLOS ONE. It shows that potatoes are one of the most nutritional valued foods anywhere. They can provide better nutrition value, penny for penny, than most other vegetables. So lots of potassium, high-quality calcium, and they're second only to beans. This was done at the University of Washington. So from now on, just remember, potatoes are really good. They're low in calories and high in nutrients, and that's a good thing. Glucosamine and chondroitin found to reduce cancer. Now, this is the first study of its kind, by 45%. That's a tremendous reduction in cancer. Here's what it says from the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Cause Control, that glucosamine together with chondroitin may act as an anti-inflammatory, and in the process it offsets the development of colorectal cancer. Quote, high use of the supplements was found to reduce colorectal cancer by 45% compared to non-use. So, quote, since colorectal cancer is a major cause of death, it's important that we seek potential preventative strategies which are safe, effective, and easily implemented. Glucosamine and chondroitin supplements have been shown to be safe and are already widely used, and it is therefore important that we seek to better understand the suggestive association between use of these supplements and colorectal cancer, end quote. Now, colorectal cancer is inexpensive, it's easy to use, and generally people use it to help with their joints, arthritis, pain, and inflammation. Now you have another use. I'm opposed to the use of high fructose corn syrup because I've done the research. We have an ongoing article that we add to on a monthly basis. And I began writing this article 30 years ago. I wrote it after a major national debate on NBC where I debated Dr. Elizabeth Whalen of the American Council on Science and Health, a very pro-industry group. She and I debated on the subject of sugar. She was for it, I was against it. And after that, I just decided to keep an ongoing collection, and I have this article called Sweet Suicide. And it just keeps getting more and more and more comprehensive. So there's just hundreds of studies on why sugar is bad, but also now on all the politics. Who's behind all that blocking information, blocking us from making decisions? Because if you have a study comes out says sugar is bad, but then you have someone goes on television or another study says sugar is good, doesn't harm you, we don't look to see who funded the studies. If the one that's showing it was bad was funded by independent research, and the one that was saying sugar is good is funded by a think tank that's funded by the sugar industry, well, then that's not objective at all. But we never get to that level. But that's what's been going on everywhere. Pesticides, you'll find they're bad. Suddenly the pesticide industry funds studies. So when you see studies saying that high fructose is not bad, look behind that and you'll see industry money. Here is the latest on why we should not be consuming high fructose corn syrup. Because it can cause addictions almost identical to cocaine addiction. This is from the Canadian Neuroscience Meeting. Quote, showing high fructose corn syrup can cause behavioral reactions similar to those produced by drugs of abuse such as cocaine. These results, presented by addiction expert Dr. Leary, associate professor of neuroscience and applied cognitive science, University of Guelph, suggest food addiction could explain at least partly the current global obesity epidemic, partly caused by these ingredients. The same brain circuits are involved when people crave high fructose corn syrup, that's your soft drink, or candy bar, as when drug addicts think about drugs. There is significant activity in all areas of the brain, especially in the hippocampus, when consuming potent sweeteners. That region is related to learning, memory, and also related to a lot of things such as sensory and motor impulse and emotional behavior. The stimulators are also sent messages of satiety to brain circuits in the orbitofrontal cortex in the striatum, which have been linked to craving and desire in cocaine addicts. While high fructose corn syrup, which is a mixture of potent, concentrated, simple sugar, fructose, and glucose, came into use in the 1970s, and by 2010, the average American was consuming 80 pounds of it a year. Overall dietary intake of fructose has increased on a great deal. So now we have an understanding of why people will continue to crave certain sweet foods and feel withdrawal when they're going off of them. Even last night, late last night, in fact, it was about 2 in the morning, I'm helping with an intervention in California, in Los Angeles, where two daughters in their 30s were helping their father. He was in complete denial of his addiction, but the family had to do something because the man was down out and very sick. And when I was going over how hard it is, and therefore the approach that I would suggest you take when you're dealing with someone who's in denial, a lot of people who are in trouble are in denial. They just refuse to say, I need help. I'm suffering right now. I could use some input. Instead, there tends to be, I'm okay. I'm not out of control. And all the while you're looking at someone who's morbidly obese, you're looking at someone who is drinking or doing drugs, and they are out of control. But now we understand that not only is it behavioral and epigenetic and conditioning, but it's also the biochemistry. And how often have you seen alcoholics crave sugar? You go to an AA meeting and you go outside and you watch how many of the donuts and coffee and sugar they're consuming, massive amounts. Look at how many people who are on marijuana, which, by the way, contrary to popular culture, is just this really cool thing. I'll show you some people whose lives are totally destroyed and their families' lives totally destroyed because of their addiction to marijuana and what it did to them and ended up in psychiatric hospitals or brain tumors. And I've worked with these people. And I've seen the science. The fact that we don't want to acknowledge something's wrong doesn't mean that it's not wrong. And I'm not talking about the morality of it. I'm not talking about the ethics of it. I'm talking about purely the science of it. I know two people personally whose whole lives have been destroyed because of their use of marijuana and what it did to their bodies and brains. So now we know that fructose can do something very similar. It can adversely affect the chemistry of your brain, so you crave it. And once you have that sugar high, then you feel a satiety. And that's what it says in the article, a satiety. You feel satiated. You feel fine. You feel full. You have your fix. But then it starts to wear off about 4 hours later. And now you start getting agitated and irritable and hyper and aggressive and moody, just like a coke addict. And therefore you have to re-hit yourself. And that, of course, leads to obesity. It leads to dental decay. And so we think that we're doing someone a favor when we get them off alcohol, but then they become a sugar addict. It's no replacement. There's a way of detoxing the body completely. Also, there's some controversy about Letro or vitamin B17. And of course, the establishment says it is completely fraudulent. There's no benefit to it. That's not correct. I have personal, intimate knowledge of this. I was a research scientist at the time, in the early 1970s, at the Institute of Pi Biology. Now, most of the people there were orthodox scientists doing chemotherapy work, looking for the newest drug. I was the strange bird doing nutrition and anti-aging work. I had spoken with a doctor at Sloan Kettering on several occasions, quietly, and he had a lot to say. And this is a man who wanted me to know, and I in turn had other people know, and I wrote about it, that he was using Laetrile, and he was able to stop the metastasis, the spreading of cancer in mice. It inhibited the growth of small tumors, and he said that it was a major cancer preventative, and he did this several times. His name was Dr. Sugiura, S-U-G-I-U-R-A. Unbeknownst to me, there was also another person who was working inside Sloan Kettering named Ralph Moss. And Moss was later fired from Sloan Kettering, and then I brought Moss over to my apartment, and I introduced him to Steve Dunleavy of the New York Post, and then he gave the story about how Sloan Kettering was covering up a very important cancer treatment, and that made headlines, and that also made another activist out there in Moss, and he's done a very good job of, in fact, an exemplary job of sharing insights about cancer. But nothing ever happened with Laetrile. I believe that we should have today some brand new studies that are done to finally, once and for all, put this in perspective. And I believe they will show that Laetrile should be a major part of our cancer therapy. Also, finally up here, I mentioned a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it shows, according to them, that fish oil doesn't do any benefit whatsoever in preventing heart disease. And of course, the mainstream media runs with that. But I knew that that couldn't possibly be true, because I've seen thousands and thousands of people I work with benefit from using fish oil. Plus, I also study all the scientific literature. That's why I provide you with original, cited, peer-review literature, every single comment I make when it comes to health and nutrition. When I'm doing my beginning of the show citations, I always give the citations. So how in the world could all these other hundreds of studies showing the omega-3 fatty acids working, and yet their study didn't work? Well, it was simple. All you had to do is look for the evidence. And what was the evidence? The evidence was, who paid for the study? It was paid by the pharmaceutical industry, three of them, including one of them that produces a statin drug. Therefore, there's direct competition. Pfizer, you also had the Society of Antibiotica, and you had a Sigma Tau. These are all pharmaceutical companies and doing heart drugs. And then that was one red flag, but the big red flag that any real health journalist in America should have seen, and certainly the editors in the New England Journal of Medicine and their peer reviewers should have noticed, was the placebo. A placebo is supposed to be an inert, non-active ingredient, like, let's say, fiber, or it could be a simple sugar, like lactose, or just sucrose, and it's in small amounts. It's so small that it wouldn't have any biological activity. So when the study came out and the study's authors did state that they were surprised that people lived longer on both the placebo and the active ingredient, but in spite of that, they said there was no benefit. Okay, so what sugar did they use in the placebo? Well, there was no placebo. They used a DHA. Well, hold on. DHA, that's your active ingredient in the omega-3 fatty acids, fish oils. Yes, but it's also one of the ingredients in olive oil. They used olive oil as their placebo. Well, olive oil is known in hundreds of studies to be an essential part of the Mediterranean diet. And because it has the essential fatty acids in it, which are helpful for the heart, then how in the world could you compare the olive oil as a placebo with fish oil and come up with any difference? They're almost the same. And indeed, that's what the study found. But they both allowed the people with heart disease to live longer. And that's what all other studies found. So instead of doing the right work and using a placebo that is inert, they use something that's virtually equal. Now, is it possible that they were just so dumb that they just didn't know what they were doing? Yes, it is possible. Could they have cheated with intent? Could have. We don't know. But clearly, this is one of the worst pieces of science I've ever seen in my entire life. And why the New England Journal of Medicine editors did not see what I just gave you, or any of the newspaper columnist who reported on this, but this is one of the things I have to do constantly, is correct all the misinformation that goes out. And most of what goes out there is misinformation. Physicians for Committee on Responsible Medicine says eggs increase your risk of heart disease and diabetes. And that's according to a major group of studies, 14 studies. And you can increase your risk of a heart attack and diabetes by up to 68% when you're eating eggs on a daily basis. So my suggestion, stop eating eggs on a daily basis. And also a very important study from Tel Aviv University Faculty of Medicine show breastfeeding can help prevent children from developing ADHD later in life. Good. That's good news. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to share the latest on everything that empowers us. We're about empowering people. And I want to go to a public health issue to share with you now. And this is from Luca Schachter from Wake Up World. And I'll quote it. It's not long, but it's important. And I've independently verified the statistics here. Quote, "The only safe vaccine is a vaccine that is never used." So says Dr. James Shannon, National Institutes of Health. Let me repeat that. The only safe vaccine is a vaccine that is never used. Dr. James A. Shannon, National Institutes of Health. Well, now think of this. Your child gets up to 49 different doses and 14 vaccines before the age of 6? And that's caused an awful lot of people to begin to question the safety and efficacy of vaccines. So here is the latest statistics on this. And quote from the Helsinki Declaration of the International Code of Medical Ethics. Transcripts of the meeting also show that some of the committee members had extensive ties to pharmaceutical companies and that the members frequently cooperated with vaccine manufacturers on strategies aimed at boosting vaccine uptake. Some at the meetings had discussed not giving the public the information. And even when Freedom of Information Act was requested and some of the documents given, much of it was redacted, especially anything that showed their commercial affiliation. Quote, "revealed a clear and disturbing lack of transparency as some of the information was removed from the text prior to transcript release." And here are the summaries. Here's what the public and the media is never told. Quote, "Vaccines contain a combination of at least 39 different highly toxic metals, cancer-causing substances, toxic chemicals, live and genetically modified viruses and bacteria, contaminated serum containing animal viruses and foreign genetic material, extremely toxic decontaminants and adjuvants, untested antibiotics, none of which can be injected without causing any harm." Vaccine contaminants have included bovine, cow, avian, chicken, and monkey viruses and bacteria, such as streptococcus, in the DPT vaccines. How do we know this? Pediatrics, Volume 75, Number 2. There is no scientific study to determine whether vaccines have really prevented diseases. Rather, disease graphs show vaccines have been introduced at the end of the epidemic when the disease has already finished or in its late stages. In case of smallpox, the vaccine actually caused a great deal of the incidence of disease before public outcry led to its withdrawal. There are no long-term studies on vaccine safety. Very short-term tests are carried out where the vaccinated subjects are checked against another group who are given another vaccine. Technically, the test should be carried out against a non-vaccinated group. No one really knows what protocols are followed at such industry-based or industry-sponsored trials. The mercury, aluminum, and live viruses in vaccines may be behind a huge epidemic in autism, 1 in 55. 83 suspected cases of vaccine-causing autism have been awarded compensation by the U.S. Vaccine Court. Both the smallpox and the oral polio vaccine are made from monkey serum. This serum has been had many monkey viruses to enter the human bloodstream. Out of these, the only research virus is SV40, which has been found to be carcinogenic. These viruses continue to be in the vaccine. The presence of SV40 in various human cancers has been demonstrated. Today it is known that the virus, SV40, is being passed on to future generations as its presence in the mother's milk and human sperm have been established. The number of polio cases has declined before the widespread administration of the Salk vaccine. Cases which have previously been reported as polio are now being reported as meningitis. Many doctors argue that diseases during childhood are due to the body exercising its immune system. Suppressing these diseases causes the immune system to remain underdeveloped, causing the various autoimmune disorders in adults like diabetes and arthritis that have become epidemics today. Vaccines suppress the natural immunity of the body and not natural antibodies, and the body does not make as many natural antibodies as it did before. The mother's milk, therefore, does not contain as many natural antibodies and can no longer protect the child against the disease as it once could. The courts in the United States have paid $2 billion in damages thus far to people who have been injured by vaccines. Vaccines try to create humoral, which means blood-related immunity, whereas it has been found that immunity is developed at various levels, humoral, cellular, and organ-specific. We still don't know enough about the human immune system and therefore should not interfere with it. Those are just some of the statements from this report, and yet that's the kind of information that is not given in the mainstream media. And finally today, the real numbers on poverty in the United States. This is from Paul Buchheit of Alternet. Quote, the Census Bureau has reported that one out of six Americans lives in poverty, a shocking figure, but it's actually much worse. Inequality is spreading like a shadowy disease throughout the country, inflicting more and more households, and leaving a shrinking number of financially secure families to maintain the charade of prosperity. Here are the latest actual statistics. Almost 50% of Americans have no assets. None. It has gotten worse in the last 3 years. We have seen one of the worst 30-year declines in wages. And as low-wage jobs have replaced formerly secure middle-income positions. Based upon wages, over half Americans are now in poverty. And to show you how bad that is, that's less than $19,000 a year for a family of three, or $23,000 a year for a family of four. And based on wage figures, 75% of Americans are near poverty. Let me repeat this. According to the IRS data, the average household in the bottom 75% earns about $31,000 per year. To be eligible for food assistance, a family can earn up to 130% of the federal poverty line, or about $30,000 for a family of four. So right now, 75% of Americans are near the poverty line of $31,000. There's only $1,000 separating. That'll happen in the next year. That means then that 75% of Americans will be living in poverty, have no assets. And yet this is not being discussed, and there's no effort on behalf of Congress or anyone else to address this issue. And their only idea is an austerity program followed upon the completely failed one being used in the European Union countries. Take away more from those who have so little or nothing to begin with. Now, I'm out here on the road, and I'm filming people who, at one time, had been living what they thought was the American dream. And they worked hard. They were either conservative or liberal or independent. They were productive members of their society, and today they can't pay for food, utilities, mortgage or rent, and medicines. They're going deeper into debt. People are skipping meals. People are eating cat food. You have no idea until you watch this film how bad it is. And yet from the outside, not everything looks like a ghetto. Not everything looks like Detroit or Camden, New Jersey, or Compton, California. So as much as a person can, they try to maintain some sense of self-respect and some sense of normalcy. But they are dead broke. And this is at the same time that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and the White House and the Council on Economic Advisors has given $21 trillion to the largest banks in the United States and Europe and the largest corporations in the United States and Europe, and not a penny to the small businesses of America or to the person who needs it. No one's had their loans forgiven. Students haven't had the interest on their loans forgiven. In fact, the interest has just doubled from 3.3 to 6.5%. And the government makes 33 cents out of every dollar of a student loan. So the next time any politician tells you they feel your pain, really? Do they? And they care about you. Do they? No. They do not. If they did, then they would have done the following. They would put a moratorium on all home foreclosures. They would have allowed people to negotiate a 20% payment on their homes, no matter what their income, so they wouldn't lose their home. They would have forgiven all interest on all credit card, home, and student debt. And they would have supported small businesses by giving them loans with no payment due for 3 years, providing that for every $1 million of loan, they had to hire two people at a living wage plus health benefits. That would have caused about 8 million new jobs in the economy. They have done none of that. So while 75% of the American public will be hitting in the next 12 to 24 months poverty level, that leaves only 25% who are living all right. So what do? Turn your back on what you don't want to film and see and show, and just keep showing the red carpets, the smiling people, prosperity, and people who can afford to live what they consider a quality of life. But I'm suggesting it tells a lot about us as a nation when we can turn our backs on 75% of the people as if they don't count. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. My guest is on hold from San Francisco Bay, and he is Dr. Robert Burton. He is a medical doctor. He is a journalist. He has written about the new science of brain, mind, and neuroscience and the philosophy of science. He was formerly the chief of the Division of Neurology at Mount Sinai Hospital at the University of California at San Francisco, and he was also the associate chief of the Department of Neurosciences. He received his degrees from Yale University and University of California at San Francisco Medical School, and he writes The Skeptic's Guide to the Brain, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. Nice to have you back with us.
Hi, Gary. Good morning.
We're continuing that conversation that we started last Thursday, and listeners can go to the archives to listen to that. At that time, we discussed the MRI technology that's being used to map brain activity and how neuroscientists attempt to translate brain signals into understanding behavior and thoughts and feelings. And we started to explore questions of what we can say about the mind and consciousness with any degree of certainty. So I'd like to pick up where we left off and have you speak about the relationships between our sensory activity with our world and others and ourselves, and the sense of feeling we have of being unique and separate from our external environment.
I'll try and maybe a little shorter this time. Very simply, if you think about how you relate to the external world, it's through, you know, your sight, sound, and so on. How you relate to your internal world is through sensations like hunger and thirst and so on. But if you think about it, the vast majority of our cognition occurs unconsciously, although no one knows for certain. Most people estimate it's greater than 95%. So what you're really left with is that you have one of the most important aspects of the body, namely what the brain does, occurs out of sight and sound. And so if you think about it, there has to be some mechanism whereby we know what the unconscious brain is doing. And over the last 10 years in writing these two books, it finally occurred to me that there's this sort of computational aspect of a brain. In other words, it works in silence. It calculates probabilities of recognizing a face or getting an answer right. And then it has a separate system, so a mental sensory system that allows you to experience the likelihood of that calculation being correct. That would be a feeling of knowing. It'd be a feeling of recognition. But there are a variety of other sensations that the brain also creates in order to give you a starting point. So the first one would be you get a sense of self. So just if you imagine this, that if you stimulate an area of your brain and you can actually get an out-of-body experience, you recognize that your brain has a mechanism for creating a sense of self. And this can be altered in a variety of ways. You can actually project your sense of self onto a mannequin experimentally. In other words, we see the world from the perspective of our eyeballs. If you move your eyeballs, so to speak, by putting people in the virtual reality equipment and then putting the camera some distance away from their eyes, they will actually see the world in a new perspective. But not only that, they will see themselves in a new perspective. You can project a sense of self onto a mannequin, and then if you approach the mannequin with a knife, the person will become sweaty, feel apprehensive, have a sense of panic. And what you realize is that the brain has set up a variety of sensations which collectively tell you what it's doing out of sight. So the first one is a sense of self, but then there are aspects of the sense of self. For example, you have a feeling that you have arms and legs. If somebody lifts up your arm passively, let's say you go to a doctor's office and he examines you for a shoulder problem, and he lifts up your arm, you're aware that you're not lifting up the arm, but you're also aware that it's still your arm. So those are both sensations. And if you think about it, if you lift your own arm up, you have a sense that you did it, so you have a sense of agency. But if you are someone else does it, you have a sense that it's your own arm, but you didn't do it, so you have no sense of agency in that case. And if you start to go through the things that we do, we have a sort of a construct that our brain has set up, which collectively gives us a set of sensations which we experience as a mind. Now, if you think, go back a second to the fact that when you lift your arm up, you don't feel it's you doing it if someone else does it, but you do feel it if you do it. That's a sense of body ownership, so to speak. Now, if you think about it, we have a sense of not only owning our body, but are owning our minds. So we have a sense that we are unique. Our mind's different than the rest of the world. Our thoughts are different than the rest of the world. And this sort of sense of body ownership extends to everything that we think about it. So even if somebody implants an idea in your mind, whether it's through talk radio or whether through, if there's such a thing as a group mind, we experience it as being our thought and our mind. And it gives us a sense of uniqueness. It actually gives us a sense of separation from the rest of the world. So our body is over here, our self is over here, and the rest of the world is at a distance. And they've even, there's a condition in children called Williams syndrome in which they don't have a sense of a distance between themselves and other people because of a genetic defect. And you can see that the barrier, so-called comfort space between yourself and other people, can be directly affected by biology. So if you envision yourself as feeling unique because you have a unique sense of self surrounded by a body mote, which would be your personal sense of space, which is both biologically determined, also determined by culture. In other words, people in Northern Europe have a greater distance that they're comfortable with other people than people in Mediterranean countries. So it's a combination of nature and nurture. But nevertheless, collectively, you have a sense of a unique person with unique ideas and a unique sense of self, all of which is created by unconscious brain mechanisms and doesn't correspond necessarily to any real reality. Is that what you were looking for?
Yes, I was. Let me just extend that thought and then ask you if you would extend your answer on my thought. I'd like to ask whether modern neuroscience believes that all of our conscious life and our bodily experience is simply phenomena happening inside our brain and nothing else, because I have serious issues with this limited point. We can take vision as an example. Let me just throw this at you. This is a two-way process. On the one hand, there is the inward movement of light reaching our eyes, and then there's the outward projection of images. So what we see around us is in our minds, not limited to our brains. We can almost say that when we look at something, our mind is touching it, as it were. It begs the question, then, whether if we look at the sky, do we feel the sky is inside our skulls and our skull is beyond the sky? And this is one way to understand scientific research that validates that people can sense when someone else is staring at them, although they cannot see that person. There is the argument that our mind extends beyond our brains. So I'd like to hear your comments on that and speak more about the problems and questions modern neuroscience faces when trying to explain the mind and consciousness.
Let me go back. You, first of all, you've asked the $64 question. And no matter how many interviews you do, and I do personally, I find myself stumped by the question. And the reason I'm stumped by it is the brain is a physiologic mechanism that you can study. The mind exists actually in two domains. It exists as the experiences I described a minute ago. And so it's for example, if you think you're thinking, you have an experience, a sensation of thinking. But thinking goes on the same whether or not you're thinking about it or not. In other words, the brain doesn't work differently when you don't have the sensation of thinking. So what you're really left with is the brain is a biologic function. The mind is an experience at one level, but it's also a concept at another level. So last time we talked about locus briefly, and the concept of an extended mind is gaining ground. I think that the idea that we are unique organisms, as I mentioned, really stems back to a visceral feeling that we have. And it's neither provable nor unprovable as to where the mind starts or ends. So everybody's left with their own sort of abstract concept. Now, for me, I don't think there's any way to study the mind in its totality. For example, if you have group phenomena such as all the rest of the animal kingdom has, and that extends out into to whatever size the group is, then you can't put individual people in scanners and look at individual brains and understand that mechanism. It just doesn't work that way. So what we're really left with is when you take things like consciousness, it really depends what you mean by consciousness. If you're talking about consciousness as the way a neurologist like myself goes to the bedside and tries to analyze a patient's medical problem, that's one definition of consciousness. If you take a kind of literary view like James Joyce, you'll have an entirely different feeling of consciousness, which obviously is related to the person's environment. It's related to his cultural background, and other his past, not only his own personal history, history, his family, etc. And everybody picks and chooses as though they think they have an answer. These are all stories we tell. So to me, the difference between the brain and the mind is the difference between science and storytelling.
I appreciate
that
answer.
I don't know if that helps you.
It does. You've given me an honest answer, and that I appreciate. My last question's in two parts. There's a growing body of research supporting the theory that the brain is neuroplastic, that the brain cannot be reduced to an unchanging organ, and that we can, in fact, learn or develop qualities such as empathy and compassion when before we were very non-compassionate and capable of relating to the suffering of another person, particularly a stranger. Now, this was recently shown in a study at Northeastern University with students exhibiting more empathy towards others after learning and practicing meditation. So, from your perspective, what is the current scientific understanding of neuroplasticity, and what does it tell us about the mind and consciousness? And then, from the neuroscientific perspective, what can we change intentionally in our brains that will reflect upon our thinking and actions, specifically people trying to break old habits, addictions, or to decide they want to change their lifestyle? For example, switching from a meat diet to a vegetarian diet, it requires something called willpower. A strict reductionist view would say that humans don't have any free will. In the case of an addiction, that certainly has biochemical components to it. What does our brain teach us about our ability to exert free will, to initiate change? And if a person is weak in their willpower, are there ways to strengthen it?
You asked a few questions rolled into one.
Yeah.
Let me try and go back to basics. Imagine that you're a newborn. When you're a newborn, what you have going for you in the beginning is with your genetic acquisitions and your intrauterine developmental exposure and so on. And you have a little, as a newborn, you have relatively little, quotes, willpower. Over time, you learn willpower. If you have proper parenting and so on, you learn discipline, you learn to put off immediate goals for long-range goals, etc. Eventually, you learn willpower. Now, you ask about neuroplasticity. Well, neuroplasticity is just a fancy way of saying that as we learn, our brain changes. And although it's a new word, I mean, we've known all along that you can learn new things as you get older. For example, I've tried to learn the piano in the last few years, and even though I'm getting older, I'm learning. So every time I learn a new song, I'm laying down new pathways in the brain, firming up certain circuits, etc. So neuroplasticity, I think, even though it's a new idea in terms of the language, I think we've always known that we can learn things, even as old folk. So now what we're left with is you have a very plastic brain as a child. It gets progressively less plastic as you get older, but it doesn't lose neuroplasticity. It just means it's harder. And everybody knows it's easier to learn a language when you're five. It's easier to learn to play an instrument when you're young, learn a sport when you're young. But it doesn't mean it's zero when you're older. It just means it's harder. So neuroplasticity becomes more difficult. And in part, it's because it's overcoming all the circuits that you've already laid down. So when people ask me about free will, I don't really use that term anymore because I don't think it's meaningful. Free will is sort of an archaic term that's arisen out of medieval and often theological ways of thinking about personal responsibility. But if you go back to the idea of most of our thoughts are primarily complex thoughts are unconscious, and it seems imprudent to say that conscious thought is where free will exists, but unconscious thought it's simply involuntary. In other words, if you try to think of a name and you can't come up with a name, you go to bed at night, and in the morning you wake up with the name, your unconscious has been given the instruction to think of the name. So in that sense, it's willful, but it makes no sense to say that the unconscious is willful. But on the other hand, it doesn't make any sense to say that it's not willful. So the language kind of falls apart. I think, realistically, we act as organisms, much of which is unconscious, and as we mentioned earlier, some of it's related to the outside world in relationship to other groups, people, family, whatever. Collectively, you operate with a certain amount of freedom to make decisions within the constraints of what your biology is built up for you. Now, so you go back to, can you learn empathy, which is really the question at hand. To me, empathy is partly genetic, partly developmental, partly parental, and by the time you're old enough to know the difference between empathy and no empathy, you have a very, you have a certain innate bias. Some people are naturally empathic, and others by nature tend to ignore other people and seem to be indifferent to their plight. I'm not sure how much you can change that. I do believe that it's worth trying, because if it doesn't work, we're kind of sunk as a world. I mean, I think the civilization will collapse if we can't generate empathy. The real question is, how can you acquire the traits, namely discipline and self-awareness, and that will lead to a concern for other people? Now, that itself is a hard road to follow. You have to have learned as a child a sense of discipline, which is meditation is discipline. So is thinking about other people from their perspective. It requires introspection. There are a lot of traits that you acquire early in life that collectively, if they're in place, will allow you to be empathic. Whether or not that you can overcome those traits is, I'm modestly hopeful that you can do that. And one of the reasons I write these books is with the hope that we can gain perspective on how other people think and feel. But I know it's very hard as you get older to change these really basic fundamental aspects of our personality. I almost get the feeling that it's better, the way forward is to have parents teach their kids at a younger age. In other words, it gets to be a harder process the older you get.
It's not
I think you can teach young kids empathy much easier than you can teach a 45-year-old who's fixed in his ways.
I would agree. I just believe we have to make it a priority in our school system. Thank you very much for coming on again. Once again, you give us just a great deal to concentrate on, and the book is A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, St. Martin's Press. Dr. Robert Burton, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Gary. My pleasure. Have a good
I'm Gary Knoll. Now we go to the last part of our program. But let's say hello to Luann Panessi first. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary.
All right, let me say something real quick.
Mm-hmm.
We are filling up, and I don't want people who really would benefit from coming to the upcoming retreat from not being able to do so. Real quick, here are the highlights. I'm only doing this once this year. I have found what I consider one of the finest places in the world to do a retreat, because it's blending the beauty of nature, quiet, serene, healing, the waters, the mineral waters, the elegance, the intimacy of the environment, and the best group of people I've ever brought together, ever, in 400 retreats. We're going to do it in depth. It's 2 weeks, but people can come for one if they can't be there for two. It starts on Sunday with orientation the 7th of July and goes for 1 or 2 weeks. And here's what it is. It's yoga with a master yoga teacher that's going to be teaching several times a day. Spectacular view on a lake, and private just on the property, and you can walk around the lake. There's cooking classes. Everybody loves food, and everybody's going to get 3 great meals a day plus juices all day in a special cafe in the cabana with the mineral waters. And you go in, you can have food whenever you want and juices to your heart's content. But then you get cooking classes, 2 a day for 4 hours total. Raw food cooking in the afternoon. And my daughter Shelley is doing the cooking classes. She's a master chef in the morning and wonderful to learn from. Meditation classes. In-depth meditation, including the energy movement, working with healing energies. That is in the afternoon. Then personalized training with one of the best, John Q, one of the best personal trainers who I'm bringing down. Art as healing, where a whole art center has been set up where people can have someone experience in guiding you with art, even if you've never done anything artistic in your life, in the process of healing. And then, of course, working out in the gym and water aerobics. Plenty of time for meditation, beautiful places to meditate. In pristine environment. There's nothing like this. And when you consider what it is just to go to a yoga retreat or go to a cooking retreat, or go to a meditation retreat, or go to a detox retreat, and all of this is in one. And you can do as little or as much as you want. I'll be there the whole time doing my lectures at night on healing the mind, body, and spirit. Different every night. Every class is done differently every night. Every menu is done differently. And it's all gourmet vegan. So if you want to join us, I'm going to give you a number. And you can call and someone will speak with you. It's 877. Let me just see the number here. Get the number up. I'm out on the road, so I don't have it right in front of me. I'm going to get my engineer to give it. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. We should be full. And that's another thing. I didn't want a lot of people. I wanted a smaller group so they can get a lot of attention and just have a great time. And it's very inexpensive. And it's a fundraiser for this station. It's only $2,000 for the first week and $1,500 if you stay for the second week. So you can't get that anywhere. And once you arrive, you get a cheap flight. It's out of season. That's why I started after the 4th. And you get to the place, and then it's everything's included. So you don't have to have any more expenses. 877-627-5065. Use it as a vacation, a retreat. Take a partner. Take someone. Come alone. You could change your life. And it's going to be so much fun. And it's only once, so you don't want to miss it. Luann?
Yeah, Gary. Well, you know, one of the things that I've done is I've spent a lot of time looking at all the different places around the world, around the country, that offer these themed visits. And really all I found was places that focus on, say, weight loss. You go down there and all you're doing is you're working out and they're giving you, you know, little bits of food and they're focusing and they're weighing you every day. There are other places that have a whole theme about yoga. It's all about yoga and they give you a basic, you know, kind of a bland diet and basically you're doing yoga. Or Ayurvedic healing, or another place that just detoxification. They have a medical doctor on staff, and they're checking your blood, but there's nothing in terms of the mind-body. And then finally, there are places that offer spas, which are like, you know, beauty treatments and massages and kind of things like that. But nowhere, and plus, just let me say this, the prices that these places offer, and some people know the big places around the country, you start at $10,000 a week. I mean, the lowest basic where you're sharing a room with four other people is about $8,000 a week. And then it goes on up. I mean, the prices are absolutely ridiculous. And when I actually looked at some of the pictures and looked at some of the places, because there's a lot of people in your audience, Gary, who are looking for a place like this where it's a controlled environment that helps them to reconnect with their soul, with who they are, to help them reestablish healthy relationships and, you know, to just reexamine what they're doing here on the planet. And this is just about the best thing that they can do for themselves and for their families.
Well,
so,
let me put it this way. I was looking at drug interdiction programs, and they're anywhere from, on the low end, $17,000 a month up to $75,000 a month. The cancer ones and the ones where you go because you're sick, and even though they don't have medical doctors on site, those can go anywhere from $5,000 to $6,000 a week. The ones of just yoga, they can be inexpensive. I've seen them for, you know, $1,500 to $2,000, but it's just yoga. I went to one once, and it was 60 people sleeping on mats in a gymnasium and eating brown rice and
I'm not even counting them. I even called that a vacation.
So anything like this that offers all that this is being offered for these 2 weeks, I included in here because this is a fundraiser for the radio station. I included in here the idea that we want to be able to have people otherwise not afford it, be able to afford it by just giving them everything, the cooking, the yoga, the meditation, but not a little bit, but full-on classes. If you just went just to do one of these, you'd be getting all that you needed in a beautiful environment. So we want people who want to come, call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Now, Luann, any questions, not about this, but any mail from the listeners?
Oh, boy. I've got one here, Gary. you're not gonna appreciate this one. I did get an article from Alicia O'Leary from, looks like she is from, I don't know where she's from, she doesn't say. And she sent me an article that said GE to invest billions of dollars in fracking. And this is coming from Pittsburgh. And there they are, investing billions of dollars in gas drilling and fracking. They're using a new laboratory in Oklahoma, buying up related companies, and placing a big bet that cutting-edge science will improve profits for clients and reduce environmental and health effects of the boom. So this is not good news. The alarms are out. So all of the people against fracking, we need to get together and make our voices known.
I agree, because what fracking does, it causes an enormous amount of our precious drinking water, our clean water, to be used in a stew of toxins that are then left in the ground or in pools by it that have been shown to contaminate the local area, not just the air, but also the soil and the water. And I believe that in a very stressed time when people are given the inducement, just lay out a little bit of money and you'll be able to have an income coming in, it's very little and the value of your property goes to zilch. We're working on challenging the fracking in every state. Right now we're working on genetic engineering and trying to get that, but fracking's right up there and closing down Indian Point, New York, and other places, closing down nuclear. We've got many things we're addressing, and it's going forward on all of them. By the way, I just got from Kathleen Francis from Sedona. She's one of the major activists out there. She says, excellent, handed out copies of the film. And evidently there's a website, Forbidden Knowledge TV, that is had it go viral. But we've had over 100,000 people download Seeds of Death. And just one comment is from Dr. Ronald Klatz, medical doctor, co-founder and president of the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. Quote, congratulations, Gary. Your latest vid on GMO is beyond excellent. It's the best thing on the net. You're free to use my endorsement on this vid. Great work. That's Dr. Ronald Klatz, the founder of the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. They have, I think, 30,000 members. So we're getting the word out at the grassroots level, everywhere we can. Share the information. Let people know. Watch the video. It's free. Read the articles. They're free. Become educated. Then become active at the state level. To your larger issue there, tomorrow I'm going to talk about our stressed ecosystems, because there's one thing, Luann, that fracking will absolutely do. It will stress our ecosystems. Here is a little fact, and this is from Stephen Lee of the Inner Press. He says, everyone knows, quote, water is life. Far too few understand the role of trees, plants, and other living things in ensuring we have clean water, fresh water. This dangerous ignorance results in destructions of wetlands that once cleaned water and prevented destruction and costly flooding. Around the world, politicians and others in power have made decisions based on short-term economic interests. There's your General Electric. Without considering the long-term impact on the natural environment. Quote, humans are changing the character of the world water system in significant ways with inadequate knowledge of the system and the consequences of changes being imposed. The list of human impacts on the world's water, of which only 0.03% is available as fresh water. Let me repeat that. 0.3% of the water on the planet can we drink. Quote, we have accelerated major processes like erosion, applied massive quantities of nitrogen that leaks from soil to ground to surface waters, and sometimes literally siphoned off water from rivers, emptying them for human uses before they reach the oceans. On average, humanity has built one large dam every day for the last 130 years, which distorts the natural river flows to which ecosystems and aquatic life depend over the millennia. Two-thirds of the major river deltas are sinking due to pumping out groundwater, oil, and gas. Some deltas are falling at a rate of 400% faster than global sea levels. In China, China's first national census of water discovered they've lost more than 28,000 rivers in China in the last 20 years. Most experts blame the loss on massive overuse in engineering projects to shift water from one region to another. So there you have it. So that's one more reason not to gas hydrofrack and to pay attention to water. Thank you all. We're out of time. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to standing by here, Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about immigration reform. It's a crying sham.
We look forward to it right now, Utrece Lead.